So Gary Snyder, according to Tricycle, is someone who came to Zen practice through reading the poetry, the very poetry that Roshi has assigned to us for Ango. And he said that he came to sitting practice specifically by wanting to understand where the mysteriously plain quality of some of the finest Chinese poems came from. So he has some interesting things to say about the relationship between poetry and Zen. Of course, a nature lover. When he was up in the Sierra, High Sierra in California, working on the trails, he started writing in the manner of Panchen or some of these guys. And later he went to Kyoto to actually study with a Roshi. And he says after the first year, he approached the Roshi and said, you know, sometimes I write poetry, is that okay? And the Roshi laughed and said, it's all right, as long as it comes out of your true self. He also said, you know, poets have to play a lot. Asobi. Asobi. And Gary Snyder says, well, that would seem like an odd thing to say, because the word asobi has an implication of wandering the bars and pleasure quarters, the behavior of a decadent wastrel. And he says, I knew he didn't mean that. So then, for many years, while doing Zen practice, he just quit writing poetry. And it didn't bother him. He says, his thought was, Zen is serious. Poetry is not serious. So he tried to be serious, and he didn't write any poems. And then he studied with this Roshi, Roshi Oda Seislo, for 6 years. Then, just before the Roshi died in the hospital, he visited him, had a talk. He said, Roshi, so it's Zen that's serious. Poetry is not serious. Is that it? Roshi said, oh, no. Poetry is serious. Zen is not serious. So he says, oh, I had it all wrong. And I don't know if this was by accident or was a gift he gave me, but I started writing more. And maybe he says I did a little less sitting too. But I think I had come to understand something about play. To be truly serious, you have to play. That's on the side of poetry and of meditation. In fact, he says, play is essential to everything we do. Working on cars, cooking, raising kids, running the corporation. Where's Shinko? So he says, you know, poetry is nothing special. And language is no big deal. Mind is no big deal. Meaning or no meaning, it's perfectly okay. We take what's given us with gratitude. So play, the idea of play, I think he got from one of these old Zen worthies, the one that's most associated is ryokan. But before I speak about ryokan, it struck me that Shinryu's friend Olivia knew how to play, and that she arranged her death like a Zen master. Took care of her affairs, threw a party, and departed her life in glorious fashion. So something tells me her influence will prevail from the other shore, and we needn't worry. Her teachings are already reaching far and wide. So the greatest exponent of play in the Zen lore is ryokan, the poet ryokan, poet monk. And I'm grateful to Roshi, who gifted me the latest edition, One Robe, One Bowl. Anybody who knows Roshi for 5 minutes knows that she's a gift machine. She's always giving gifts, and I'm a very lucky recipient. So this is a gift I truly treasure. And ryokan kind of turns out he exemplifies the 10th picture of the ox herding series. The guy comes down from the mountain, he's shabby, bare-breasted, tattered, covered in dust, carrying a wine gourd. And he goes into the marketplace, frequenting, what do they say, the market stalls and the brothels. And everyone he comes in contact with is moved, is awakened. He also was someone who loved to play with the village kids. He lived in a hut up in the mountain. So this is someone who had actually spent 16 years in a monastery. And then left and started to travel around interviewing different teachers for 4 years before he came full circle back to his own hometown 20 years later. And he finds himself a little hut up the mountain. And he lives there on very, very little, and still wearing his robe, and goes begging for what he needs, food. The occasional sake, I think. But he loved to play, and so he would be sometimes found like fast asleep in a barn on a haystack or something, because he'd been involved in the game of hide-and-seek and just sort of fell asleep. So, and a lot of his poems refer to his playing. He says, playing in a garden among the cherry trees. My sleeves are covered with blossoms as the flowers fall. Or playing ball with the village children this warm, misty spring day. No one wants it to end. It was not all cherry blossoms for this guy. There were many nights clearly of intense loneliness, being perished to death by the cold, freezing long winters, and not a whole lot to eat. But what he leaves us are the reflections of someone who is completely transparent, has complete
the complete openness and innocence of a child. He hides nothing. His feelings, thoughts, longings, they're all written down in this plain, unadorned language that speaks to us almost now 1,000 years later, with the direct intimacy of someone we feel we know. So this is what hooked Gary Snyder. He's committed himself to a life of poverty. And his spiritual life is clearly overflowing. This one, he says, "My life may appear melancholy, but traveling through this world, I have entrusted myself to heaven. In my sack, 3 sho of rice." Sho is a quart. 3 sho of rice. "By the hearth, a bundle of firewood. If someone asks what is the mark of enlightenment or illusion, I cannot say. Wealth and honor are nothing but dust. As the evening falls, I sit in my hermitage and stretch out both feet in answer." So, we're back to the theme Anraku brought up. Stretch out both feet in answer. This is someone who knows how to relax. He's let go clearly of concerns about other people, what they might think. You can imagine, you know, someone 20 years away in a monastery, you know, while maybe other mothers' sons have become government officials or become farmers or raised families or become people of standing in the community, this guy comes back and he doesn't have the wherewithal to feed himself. So clearly this is not of concern. This is someone who has slain a lot of demons, a lot of the demons Anraku has referred to. All the demons known to man, the need for approval, recognition, comfort, success. It's like he no longer has any cows to lose. So what's his secret? "I have entrusted myself to heaven." So this is John Stevens translating. Be curious to know what the Chinese could be, the Tao. I mean, the dollar says, "In God we trust." So we, as a culture, make claims to also lay our trust in God. But do we really? "I've entrusted myself to heaven" is the ultimate posture. of trust that is antithetical to the egoic mind, you see, because the egoic mind says, I can't trust anything outside of myself. I can't trust anybody or anything else. I'm in charge. Now, we learn from yoga how much effort it takes to actually relax the body. You know, Katie, restoration, in our restoration practice, all kinds of props, you know, these bricks on the side of the thighs and pillows on the head and mats on the spine. We got, you know, things to tie the legs up so we can all manner of supports. And it was fabulous but you could see the body. We needed these supports to just lie back and open up. And there was one, I recall, where we're completely like, you know, the thighs are open. It's like your back being in the posture of a baby waiting for its diaper to be changed. Now, how more open and vulnerable can you get? And as an adult, you can feel the remove from how what a baby is like in that same complete with its mother, complete surrender. That's what it is. It's trust. Now, you might imagine, the diaper is dry and everything is going well, the baby's been fed and it feels like all of its needs are being met. It's being held. It's been taken care of. This infant is a happy baby. Blissful, happy, open. Now, you kind of imagine maybe the diaper is wet. And the mother's not coming. You know, once or twice, okay, infant will recover. But, you know, you throw in a few things of maybe repetitions, disappointments, failure to respond, and the child now is getting confused, upset. And that relaxed openness is turning to something else. It might turn into protest. If this becomes systematic, neglect, then you might find, or erratic, the child can't actually depend on the caregiver to be there in a reliable fashion, then the child can actually just begin to, of course, be in a rage, and then collapse into apathy. It's too painful to experience the sensations. They become overwhelming of need, of fear. And so the infant shuts down, and the heart, if you will, at that point sort of just begins to not feel. It develops a sort of an incrustation, a self-protective layer. So it doesn't feel things quite as acutely. So when Roshi was mentioning that line about not letting your heart, how to go, not letting your heart be wounded by wanting to cross the stream. it occurred to me that many of us who come into practice have already had our hearts plenty wounded, maybe even by the time we're two. And so out of that, there's a sense of, our sense of trust might have undergone some vicissitudes, shall we say. And out of that self-protective, when we even use the practice, indeed, to hunker down, not feel, to even develop even a stronger kind of a thing of macho, superhero, I don't feel the pain in my knees. I'm beyond that. With that loss of connection, basically, connection to the heart, to that open, vulnerable heart, instead, you see, our reference is external. Or we might try and sort of adapt. Okay, maybe if I'm X, Y, and a Z, I will get what I need. And the kind of the growing emptiness we experience when we're out of touch with our being. That emptiness needs to be filled from the external world. And in that way, we try to increase the cows. Maybe the more cows I have, the fuller, the more worthy, the more lovable I'll feel. But see, the thing about our woundedness is, it's like light and darkness are a pair. So from the very place we are wounded sprouts flowers. So the child that feels it has to be perfect to win the mother's, maybe if I don't cry, she'll come. Or maybe if I hold myself differently, she'll come. A child who develops then that capacity to do things properly or right, on the one hand, develops the quality of impeccability. The child who might be neglected or lost, just not seen, might develop this brilliant artist sensitivity, and so they show themselves to be different. Or in the Zendo, they're always the one who's chanting just a little differently than everybody else, so she doesn't get lost. Or, the child who's been mistreated, unjustly treated, maybe exploited, abused, is the one who develops this exquisite sensitivity for other people's pain, becomes the champion of the underdog, who becomes the protector. And so we see, out of this place where we are hurt, not seen, not recognized, these beautiful, beautiful qualities emerge. And so our practice then, we talk about the role of, where does relaxation come in, given that there are all these contractions that we've, you know, this is how I need to be. How does the practice help us to relax? Well, the props that we use, the supports, everything that we have here are all the props and supports. Counting the breath, coming back, sitting still, coming back to one. Anything to encourage us to take our seat and stay, and not, because what we're doing, you see, is, as you said, moving and distracting ourselves from what? From the pain, from the original pain, from the that part of us that does not feel worthy, that does not feel good enough, that feels in some way we're flawed. Roshi talked about the fake support. But Zen is not about giving fake support, the coddling, the chicken soup. The support Zen offers is to go right into, to enter right there where it hurts. And so it offers a kind of radical fasting or poverty, just like with ryokan. Cutting out all the distractions, all the chatter, all the static. You know, because we know, left to our own volition, none of us would sit, 8 hours a day. We're not the spiritual giants of someone like ryokan. Well, maybe some of you are. Yeah, maybe there are a couple of people looking around. But it wouldn't be me. So we see the schedule, the practice, all the beautiful, you could also say play, that happens here. The sounds. That assistant Tenzo is striking that bell before the Tenzo makes the offering. Pure play. Play, you know, remember, is absorption. There's nothing more absorbed than a child at play. Complete oneness. The play of the servers, choreography, serving us. The play of the pad of the drum that develops into this thunderous crescendo, and then clack with the clackers. Play, all of this play. The Tenzo's food, the cooking. In Samu, you see it too, everywhere you look. People mopping, raking leaves, doing projects. Extraordinary manifestations. So these are all supports. Each Sangha member, you see, we can't do it alone. Each Sangha member is bringing us and showing us a jewel from the net. You know, teaching. On one side, I've got someone teaching me selfless service. On the other side, someone teaching me impeccability. Opposite, I've got someone teaching me gentleness of heart. So all, everywhere we look, teaching, each person teaching what they embody. Ryokan also had his dark night of the soul. You know, when you think of also even someone like Jesus Christ, when he can sometimes lose it. God, why hast thou forsaken me? There's doubt. There's little wavering of trust. Ryokan is traveling at and he's staying at an inn. And he's describing a time of confusion. Mid-autumn. The wind and rain are now at their most melancholy. A wanderer, my spirit is inseparable from this difficult road. During the long night, dreams float from the pillow. Awake suddenly, I have mistaken the sound of the river for the sound of the rain. Mid-autumn. Looking around too, I see that there are a bunch of us who are about mid-autumn in our lives. I first met Anraku 23 years ago, Zen Mountain Monastery. Dancer, she was a nerd dancer there still. She could leap, make a dancer's leap from here that would go up in the air and reach down there. Kaizen also, I knew 20 years ago. We were in residency together. Shinryu, when he first arrived at 15 Washington Place, morning meditation. I remember him doing Kin Hin. It was a fierceness. You could see it just from how he did Kin Hin. So it's very, very beautiful to practice with these old wines and then also the new and the medium wines in this great wine cellar we have. So, mid-autumn, the wind and the rain are now at their most melancholy. So you can hear, like, there's a misery here. It's just that point in your life where you say, did I do the right thing? You know, should I? Maybe I should just have, you know, married and settled down with a bunch of kids. What am I doing anyway? A wanderer. My spirit is inseparable from this difficult road. It's almost bordering on reproach. Bordering on, ugh, damn, what am I doing with my life? During the long night, dreams float from the pillow. Alternate realities, obviously, you know, I'm stuck here. What if, I mean, fantasize where I could be right now. Awake suddenly. This is the awakeness that Shinryu talked about, the at-one-ment. The at-one-ment that becomes a complete moment of recognition that this moment, my experience, I am not separate. This is the one fabric. I cannot separate from a subtilian of anything. So awakes and I have mistaken the sound of the river, the stream, the source, the subtle source, the stream, the sound of the river, you know, for the wail of the rain. Here I am complaining about my life conditions. Thinking it's rain, why doesn't it stop already? Go away, rain. But it's actually the river. So you see, he's completely, the complete intimacy, his capacity to be utterly one with, to wake up in just this where I am. Not pushing and saying, all right, the pain in the knee now. If I really were a good sitter, I wouldn't have a pain in the knee. If I did my yoga, if I... All of the different alternate, the ways we jiggle and bargain and think that there is a better way, different way, an alternate reality that would suit me better than what's happening. And so this is where we come to the basis of his sense of trust and his capacity to relax into, is that he knows what he knows. And from that place of wakefulness, you know, all right, it's too bad it's raining, or it's too bad my knee hurts. But infinite reality has to take some form, and this is the form it's taking right now. And I may as well not equivocate. And indeed, I can use it as the place, as Shinryu said, to defy death. To use that very aching knee as the place to wake up. No one wakes up in comfort. That's why the Buddha left the palace. The nun Rugetsu wrote this poem after she was told there was no room for her at the inn. Another wanderer. Refused at the inn, but I took this unkindness as a gracious act. Under the hazy evening moon, I slept among blossoms. So, it's very normal and natural. It's human, you see, to want to be put up in a comfortable inn. Yeah, give me four-poster bed, plush, my own bathroom. Throw in a VCR, too. I can watch the movies. We want to be comfortable. That's human. But we need to watch how that constantly seeking for the comfort being put up at the inn. Can itself become our prison. And that to find when we are refused, when there's discomfort, that is our opportunity, that in fact is our gift. That is the gateless gate, to use that pain, that discomfort, that whatever it be it chaotic mind, monkey mind, comparing mind, be it aching in the hips, in the knees, in the lower back, sense of inadequacy, sense of despair, a sense of whatever. And use that as the way to go deeper, to find the river, to find the peach blossoms.
I vow to pour.